Okay, first I'd like to thank Fang for inviting me. Actually, we've never met, I'm sure maybe you are Fang. Nice to meet you. So, it's always my great pleasure to come back to Santa Barbara. And one second. So this topic is about holography, and about some way I try to understand holography. And so here is an outline. So the motivation of this work is really just poor man's understanding to holography. I'm a poor man because I don't know string theory. So I think that's definition of a problem in this field, because I don't know where I cannot really completely understand how this holography was proved or shown in the string theory way. So on the other hand, we see many evidences that this thing is more generic than the specific theories. So there is a reason that it may have a more general way to understand. So I will discuss some way I try to understand this, which is related to some very naive thoughts about space-time geometry. So So after discussing the motivation, I will talk about exactly what do I mean by this exact holographic mapping. In one sentence, it means I want to propose that the duality between bulk and boundary theory is actually just what is happening here? Sorry. That's why I turn off the Wi-Fi. In one sentence, this what I want to say is that the relation between the box theory and boundary theory is actually a unitary transformation in the Hilbert space. I will show some free fermion examples and talk about the dual of the different states, including massive and massless states, and the effect of finite temperature. And in particular, the interesting thing is how black hole can be described in some very simple model. And then I will discuss also the interaction states. Okay, so I won't review much about the holography, and probably most of you know much better than me about this. So it was found from string theory context. But the reason why we condensed matter physicists are very interested in this the main reason is that this was shown to be intrinsically related to RG. So the actual dimension can be interpreted as a energy scale, because when you go along that direction and you are the isometry of the space is the dilatation. So there is some intrinsic relation between the RG flow equations along this extra dimension and the bulk equation of motion. And that's also related to how I want to understand it. And then, the holographic duality may provide an alternative way to understand strongly correlated electron systems. So some theories may have a simple dual theory, but the theory itself on the boundary may be strongly correlated, and that's why people are interested in it. In most of the applications of the holography to condensed matter, it's like you start from the box theory, which is semi-classical, and then you can calculate the properties of the boundary theory through the box theory. So that's exactly like this this kind of applications, that the boundary theory is strongly correlated to some Lagrangian theory that we don't even write down the Lagrangian Hamiltonian explicitly, but then the box theory is something you know and you study the bulk correlation functions. Instead of doing that, in condensed matter, we're interested in asking, like, for a given boundary model, if I didn't know where, if I don't know what is the bulk dual theory, is it possible to construct the dual theory, which may or may not be the same kind of dual theory as the classical gravity? So, for example, there are a series of works of Song Hek Lee about this way to how to construct this dual series from RG scheme, generalizing RG scheme. So my attempt is also along this line, and it's a different construction which try to start from the boundary theory. So now I will start to discuss what do I mean by this Perlman's understanding. In the classical case, we know what we mean by space-time, which is described by a Riemann geometry. So we first need to specify a manifold with some points, and then we talk about distance between points. I mean, that's apparently a very simple understanding, or a very simplified understanding to geometry. There are many more interesting things in the geometry. But as far as what I'm concerned about, this is the simple things that I want to generalize to the generic quantum system. So then for a quantum system, well, we also know how to like write down a curved space and then study the quantum many-body systems in the curved space in study the field theories. But if I just give you a Hamiltonian and a Hilbert space, that defines the quantum system, and I don't tell you what's the physical interpretation, like is it a field living on some curved space or something. I just give you this matrix of Hamiltonian and the Hilbert space. Then how do you tell what geometry of space-time is this quantum system lived in? I mean, where does it live in? What is the natural way to find out the geometry? So to compare with the simple concepts in the classical case, I think the important points, things are figuring out what do I mean by point and what do I mean by distance between points. So in a short summary, what I want to propose is that a definition of points in a manifold or a discretized version of manifold, which is what I will talk about. Points correspond to a basis choice in the Hilbert space. Right? If you think about single particle quantum mechanics, then when I talk about a particle at a given point in real space, that means it has a wave function or delta function near that point. And in a lattice system, there is no problem with singularity, and there's no problem with delta function. So then I can talk about many different basis in Hilbert space. I can go to momentum space or whatever. So what makes this real space special? I think the reason why it's special is that the physics is local in the real space. If you insist to use the momentum space, Huygens space, to define your point, then the physics in general is not local, and you can scatter momentum from one momentum to another way, another one which is far away. So that's why the real space basis is special. And now, assuming I find this basis in which the Hamiltonian is local and the physics is local. So in most of the cases, that's given. You write down Hamiltonian, you know what you mean by real space. And then the next question is, now if I only know this Hamiltonian, I don't have an external way to measure distance. How do you measure distance? And the distance should be measured by some physical correlation function, because I'm not given anything else. I'm given this physical system. I should use the correlation functions to measure distance. So how do I really do that? So let's consider a very simple. Let's start from a simple gap system. So as I mentioned, we should find a suitable local basis. And then in the case of a gap system, it's clear that the real space is a good basis to choose, because the correlation functions are all local, Hamiltonian is local. So we consider some spin model on a lattice. And then this bounce stands for singulates between the spins. So you can consider some state, like a resonant valence bound state, where the state is a superposition of different ways the spins paired into singulates. So I choose this state because it's explicit that the correlation is local, like this spin is only correlated with this one in one state. And then if you are in the other configuration, then it's correlated with the other neighbor. So if the correlations are all local, then if the bounds are all short range, then the correlation is local. So now in this state, how do we define distance between these two points? So if I only know this system, then the natural thing to do is I calculate some two-point function. And then if the two points are closer to each other, then the two-point function is bigger. And if they are far away, then there's less correlation. Right? So it's natural to use some two-point function like this, connected part, to define the distance. So we know that if you have a gapped state, then the correlation looks like an exponential decay in terms of the Euclidean distance in this system, depending on Hamiltonian, maybe Euclidean distance or Manhattan distance. So it corresponds to this distance determines the correlation function. And usually the way is that you first know the distance and then you calculate the correlation. And now we want to reverse this this logic and say that if I don't have any other way to tell. Yeah.
Christian, the system you were just showing, the short range RDB, in many of these, if I calculate the two correlation function is decaying, but then there's a 4 point, which is 2.0 and 2.0, which is not really for the Hamiltonians for this one arc, actually, yet. And so then if I look at the 4 point, some of the distance looks very different.
Yeah, so I think you can view the 4 point as 2 point functions where each point evolve to size.
Yeah.
So in general, in principle, you should check all these correlation functions. And then if one of them is long range, that tells you, if one of them is longest range, you should use that one. So that's why I will mention that I think the good measure is the mutual information between two regions, because there's a bound of correlation functions, so you don't miss any of the 2 point functions. But of course, if you really want to do that, then you have to vary the size of what I mean by one site. So in principle, I should this kind of consideration about defining the distance by correlation function should be done to regions of finite size rather than points, in order to avoid what Matt said, you may miss some correlation function that's longer range, but it's harder to probe. So the mutual information may be helpful for that. So basically, if I find a correlation function, usually you know what is distance, so you know it's exponential decay. But if you don't know what's distance, then my proposal is that you should use this as a definition of the distance, to take a log of the correlation function. And then, as Matt said, there may be some other correlation function which I missed. Maybe I use the wrong one, and then this one is correlating very shortly, so I want to use the right one. And then one way to do it is avoid having bias is to define the mutual information, which is the entropy for two regions that are far away. Then the mutual information is the difference between entropy of the two regions and the entropy of the two together. So that tells you, so the reason why that's a good measure to distance is that it gives you upper bound of all the connected correlation functions. This was what Matt and the collaborators shown. So that for any operator, properly normalized the correlation function is bounded by the mutual information. So if I calculate these two regions and I see mutual information decays exponentially, then nothing else can decay slower. So that means that this is a good way to measure distance. And there is another good thing for mutual information, because I know what is this constant. So what do I mean by that constant? So going back to here, so there is a constant in front of the correlation function, which should be the maximum, which corresponds to zero distance. Right? So when you have zero distance, your correlation function is maximum. So if you use mutual information to measure the distance, then the maximum of mutual information is known. It's just Sx equals to Sy equals to maximum, and then Sxy equals to zero. That's your maximum, right? Because that's the most possible mutual information you can get. And in which case is the maximum reached? It's when these two sites are maximally entangled. Right? So say if there are d states on each site, then when the two sites are maximally entangled, then the Sx, Sy are maximum, and Sxy equals to zero. And this is the only case where Sxy where this maximum can be reached. So that means that this formula directly tells us that if I have two sites which are in the EPR pair, which are maximally entangled, then they have zero distance. And that makes sense because we know that if I have a maximally entangled state between two sites, then any operator acting on this site is has the same effect as another operator, which is the transpose of this operator acting on the other side. So that means if you have anything that's next to this site, coupled to it, then it's equivalent to you have something coupled to the other one. So there is no meaning of distinguishing these two. Like, there's no meaning of I'm closer to this one, I'm farther to the other. Yeah.
So this means that, you know, depending on your state, you may have a very different concept of distance than, you know, ordinary distance.
Yes.
You certainly produce EPR pairs and transport them to,
yes,
very distant places in ordinary distance. So,
right.
So, you know, that raises the question why this is a useful definition of distance. It's so different from the usual definition, say, in quantum field.
Well, in the, for example, in the ground state of the quantum field theory, it will go back to, in a massive case, it will go back to the ordinary distance. And then, as you said, if I make an excitation, like I create a Couriel pair, then there is some, like a wormhole between the two, mm-hmm, where the distance is very short.
But isn't that a problem? Because you would expect to be able to send information from one to the other one to call the distance zero. Not just correlations, but real sending of information. Otherwise, the concept of distance is not very useful.
Yeah. I think when you talk about sending information, that's a distance in space-time. That's like a time-like distance or like-like. Right? I mean, space-like distance is not related to sending information. I mean, this
distance, it tells you how long you have to wait to send information.
That's right. But on the other hand, as I explained, I'm trying to explain here that if I sitting here, I'm close to this one, so I can couple to it. Then you write down a Hamiltonian that couples these two. Then it acts on this state in the same way as you have a Hamiltonian term which couples you and the other one. So there is really no difference between being next to this and being next to that.
Well, again, the sharp thing is signaling.
So if I assume there is someone sitting here which can send a signal, but that someone is maximally entangled with the other thing here, then I would claim there is no difference between the process where this thing send a signal out and this thing send a signal. Because they are maximally entangled, so any operator here is equivalent to an operator on the other side in terms of the action on the state.
I think a sharp distinction would happen if you talk about classical versus quantum signaling, because sure, it would certainly take time to send information from one side to the other of this pair, but if you imagine that you can send the classical information infinitely rapidly, which I know you can, but if you imagine that you can, but the quantum information still takes time, now then this pair gives you the ability to teleport immediately. So,
well, in GR, in the case of the Einstein-Rosen bridge,
yeah,
you can't signal because even though it's a wormhole, it's not traversable.
Yeah, that's exactly the...
It's to a singularity.
Yeah. Right.
The only thing you could do is you could signal in from both sides and have the signals
right.
meet in the middle. But actually, this confused me a bit because there isn't any actual geometry in this picture corresponding to the middle, is there?
To what? To the middle?
Yeah.
No, it's just they are just connected. So, yeah, so this is...
But again, if I have two points that are close by,
uh-huh.
it's a conventional view of what that means is that I can send a signal from one point to the other point, say, in a small amount of time.
Well, and but that's only when...
Here, you have two points in your distance measure which are close by.
Yeah.
But, if I have, say, a field theory Hamiltonian acting on these degrees of freedom, there's no way I can send a signal in a short amount of time from one to the other.
Yeah, but the Einstein-Rosen bridge is exactly an example like that. I'm close by in space,
okay,
but...
Let's just think about ordinary field theory for starters, field theory on a background.
I think you're saying that there's actually two ways to go, right? There's not a unique distance between two points.
Well, there is a shortest one.
Considering the Einstein-Rosen
okay.
bridge.
No, so let me finish this sentence. So this was partly motivated by discussions with Liz Lenny and about this work of Juan and Martin and Lady Sassin about the ER equals to EPR, where the when you have a bunch of, so basically they are saying that if you have a lot of things here which are maximally entangled with the other things, then it's like then you will collapse into a black hole, but there will be a bridge between these two black holes. So, but I mean, I understand your question, but the same question applies to a classical Einstein-Rosen bridge. To a semi-classical field theory, in that background.
Well, we could also discuss that case, and also as Aaron mentioned, you can't signal from one.
That's right, you cannot.
If you have two thermal lines here, you can't send a signal from here to here in a shorter distance of time.
You cannot.
Or a shorter amount of time, you cannot.
You cannot, that's right. But on the other hand, on the other hand, the spatial distance is short. Between, like, when I'm close to the horizon here, the distance is close to zero to some point near the horizon there. Right? So it's exactly in that sense that I look at how the spatial distance.
If we're actually doing relativity, then you have a Lorentzian metric, so I guess I'm not sure what you mean by shortest distance, unless you pick a moment of time, but maybe
that's right.
Something like the extremal distance, or is it just for a static picture, or what?
I have to say that everything discussed here about mutual information only applies to spatial distance or space-like distance. So that's one problem, that I don't know how to generalize this time-like distance, because there is no such thing like a mutual information between two regions which are time-like.
But you can still do this for states that are changing with time?
Yeah, you can do it with
changing the construction time. Just involves picking some time coordinate from the...
Yeah, and then you can choose different slices, and as long as it's space-like. But in the time-like direction, I will discuss time-like time direction distance, but I just don't have in principle, I can define the time-like distance by calculating if I have an imaginary time direction, then I can calculate the correlation function and take the maximum. So it's just I don't have a nice thing like mutual information, which is known to bound with this correlation function in the imaginary time direction. So I may have to take some correlation function.
Does this notion of distance satisfy the axioms of the metric space, like the triangle inequality?
Actually, that's one interesting thing. I mean, in general, I don't know. But that's one interesting thing. You will see that's one way to tell why the critical system is naturally due to something in one dimension higher. It's because the triangle inequality has something strange. Okay, so like if I do it for this system, I'm only looking at the long distance, because at short distance, of course, I can modify the Hamiltonian without modifying the geometry. And then I don't expect that the distance formula to hold accurately in short distance. So in long distance, this will just give you back the ordinary Euclidean distance if I live in a flat space. So in this case, I know the triangle inequality works. But then when you go to critical states, it's very different. So if I...
Can I have one more question?
Yeah, sorry.
So how do we define these steps for the toric-code model, for example?
Toric-code, I can think of that as a spin model, so I can calculate spin-spin correlation, and I know it's vanishing.
In the pure toric-code model, the correlation is probably about the same as zero.
Yeah, well, so I think in the pure toric-code model, doesn't matter what you define, the correlation functions are all zero.
Because the long entanglement, right? So that's right. For the long entanglement, okay. So
because
the long entanglement
looks
like distance should be zero, right? Because the long correlation.
No, the distance is infinity.
Well, but then no difference between the toric-code model and the trivial disorder state.
Well, you cannot see it from the distance definition.
So basically, you're saying the distance can't distinguish from what is there.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense, because distance is a local property of the space, and then your topological space is sensitive to the topological property of the space. So probably, if you give the toric-code any finite correlation length, then you see it's a massive state. But whether it's a topological or not, you have to put it on a toric, look at ground degeneracy. It doesn't show up in the space-time metric. So when I have a critical state, then the correlation functions are power law in long distance. And then usually you will say, okay, this has nothing to do with geometry in condensed matter system. We will say that's just because the system goes to a phase condition. But if I live in the system, and this is the only system I have access to, and I don't have any other system to measure my distance, then I may got confused, and I thought that what happened is that I may still use this definition of distance, distance as a log of correlation function, and then I find that my distance is log of x minus y, where x minus y is the flat space distance. Okay, so then if you live in that space, you may say my geometry has changed. But it's beyond just like a change of metric, because now no metric can give you this distance. This is related to the earlier question, that how do I see that no metric can give you this distance? Because the triangle inequality is satisfied, but it's always this positive sign here. I mean, there's no equal sign. So even if I take three things along the same line, the distance of x, y is always shorter than xd plus yd. That's the property of the log function. And then and from that, you see that even if I live in that system and just use this naive way to measure distance, I will see, oh, something is wrong with my space, and the distance cannot be interpreted as a Riemann distance in my space. So what do you do? So I mean, the holography, now we already know the holography duality, then we know one way to go back to what we're familiar with is we reinterpret the space as a boundary of a higher dimensional ADS space. And then now you can call this a geodesic distance, but you go through the additional dimension. And because you go through the additional dimension, there is no third point on the boundary which lives on this geodesic line. That's why it is always rigorously, this inequality is always unequal. So that's basically a motivation that's saying that if I'm living in a critical system and I calculate correlation function, I will conclude that this is not the right basis that I use to define my geometry. If I use this basis, well, you may define some geometry, but it's not a Riemann geometry. So then, yeah.
I think you implied something, but I'm not sure if you stated it exactly with your top picture there. Are you saying that in a gap state, that not only do you have the triangle inequality, but you have this sort of interpolation property that given any two states, you can find a path between them, which is on the boundary of the triangle inequality?
Yes. So I think it's asymptotically in the long distance, large scale, that should hold.
Is some result of quantum information? How do you know that?
I don't have any rigorous way to prove that. But there is some intuitive understanding why that should be true. Because basically, in a large scale, then it's like I have a very large mass. And correlations happen like by local correlations. So basically, my correlation from x to y is done by x is correlated with z and z is correlated with y. So in general, for example, if you write down a classical statistical mechanics problem and do a high temperature expansion, then you can write correlation between these two as a sum over all different paths. And for gap state, I think in the long distance is dominated by the shortest path. In the short range, shortest correlated state. So I don't know how to prove that, but that's the reason why we should have, why this formula means correlation between xy equals to correlation xz times zy. So far I'm a little slow. What we say is that this is the motivation that for a gapless state we should define a unitary transformation in the Hilbert space to find some new basis which we call real space. And then if the correlation function in that basis looks like a geodesic distance, then that's more local and that's a better real space. So probably if you live in that universe, you will naturally feel that real space. So this unitary transformation will be more, so now I will go to the definition of this unitary transformation, which I call exact holographic mapping. So you will see it's just a generalization of renormalization group, try to make the renormalization procedure rigorous, unitary. So to say this bottom line is my 1D mapping. So let's consider 1D. So the bottom line is a 1D lattice model, 1 plus 1D lattice model. So my time is continuous, so the space is discrete. So then I define this, each vertex here is a unitary mapping, which is U. It's a unitary mapping which takes two sides, these two indices, to two other sides. So this U has four indices, and let's say each of them goes from 1 to D. So it's a D square by D square matrix, which is unitary. So it maps these two sides to other two sides. And then what physically what you want to do is that you want this black side, this index S1, this black side to represent the low energy, and then the red one to represent the high energy degrees of freedom. So you want the operators that correspond to this side to be faster evolving, and this one is slower. So then you want to repeat this procedure by doing this unitary transformation again to the low energy side. So basically you separate the high energy and low energy, you separate the degree into half-half, separate high energy and low energy, and then you take the low energy and separate it into relatively higher energy and lower energy. So in the end, what you get is a new basis where the site has some knowledge about position and also energy scale. So you have these red sites, which are highest energy and lower and lower, and then the lowest.
Yeah. It looks like you're drawing a mirror here. Like,
so it's a generalization of mirror.
Well, actually, it looks like a less of a specification, but the opposite of a generalization, because it looks like you move out the disentanglers, which are...
Well, in that sense, it's more special, but that's because I kept the entanglement between the bulk states. So I will explain the relation to mirror in the next slide.
Oh, okay.
So basically, in mirror, the graph represents a state. Here, this graph represents a unitary transformation, so it can be acted on any state. So it's that's the key difference. So it's a generalization of mirror. So
so how is energy defined?
Well, so basically, these sites correspond to some operators. I mean, like, let's say I have spin here, and after transformation, they get spin operators on this side and spin operators on that side. Yeah. So I want the spin operators here when you look at the time evolution of it, you want it to consider contain the high frequency part, and then the one on the black side to contain the low energy part. And so this is not a very rigorous separation of the energy scale.
But the starting point is you have some spin system,
right?
And is this and you're talking about nearest neighbor? So is this a one-dimensional
yeah.
specifically
yeah.
a one-dimensional?
Yeah, space? I can do the same thing in higher dimension. This example is 1D. In higher D, I will cross green.
Then you have a Hamiltonian for the whole system.
Yeah.
And then you look at nearest neighbor pairs and. Like take the expectation value of the Hamiltonian or something?
Well, so about how to choose this U, I don't have a most general criteria. I mean, so just conceptually, you want to pick the high energy one here. I think the better criteria is not looking at the energy, but looking at the entanglement between the sites. So basically, what do I mean by this has high energy? I mean, related to the motivation part. So what I want is that the bulk state is short range entangled. And the high energy, the way to pick these to be high energy states helps that, because if they all have a finite energy, then this red chain is like a massive state. It has some cutting. It's like there's some fluctuations about some cutoff scale.
Well, now I'm more confused, because energy, I understand you could define a Hamiltonian and have some, but if you're going to talk about entanglement, that depends on the state of the system. So do these
U's
depend on the quantum state of the whole system?
Yeah, so if I have two different, so I can choose any U, which gives me which will give me the unitary transformation, and because it's unitary, it doesn't lose anything, does not lose anything. But for any given boundary state, there will be some U which make the bulk state shorter in entangled. So the choice of U certainly depends on the boundary state. Yeah, it's like an RG scheme. Like if I do an RG, then I do the right one, then I can see this is on a fixed point. But if you do the other one, you may not see it. But the different choice of U is like I'm using different background geometries in the bulk. But since I'm allowing the dynamics in the bulk. So my bulk is not classical, so it doesn't you don't really lose anything. So basically, I mean, this is just another drawing of this picture. So just look at the global picture that when you have a boundary state, you do all these unitary mappings that they together, the effect of them together is just a unitary transformation from the blue one to the red one. So this defines explicitly the relation between two theories. One is what I call the boundary theory, the other is what I call the bulk theory. So it's just promoting the real space renormalization to unitary mapping. So the key thing different from ordinary RD is that you didn't throw away the high energy states, but you keep them there. They have their Hilbert space, and they are allowed to entangle with the low energy states. So you don't lose anything. And here comes the relation to Mira. So this is the generalization of Mira, and in Mira, this triangle is isometry, which means you reduce the dimension. So it's more like a real space RG. And there is this entangler there, which helps you to make the bulk space more smooth. I didn't use that because I have the entanglement between different sites, so I don't need to I don't need to modify my network to include the entanglement. My box size are entangled in general. When, if I input a state on the boundary, these sites are entangled. So the entanglement entropy does not have to be completely characterized by the network. And in the mirror, these box sites are direct product states. So that's why you need to modify the network to incorporate the entanglement. And so so basically, the mirror states is a special set of states which correspond to mapping back the direct product state to the boundary. You use this reverse mapping for acting on the direct product state. And here I'm just generalizing that to other boxes. And the generalizing it to other boxes is helpful because then you can talk about the box geometry by using correlation function. And this is like the extreme. These mirror states are like an infinite mass limit. Like the correlation functions are zero, so you cannot tell the box geometry from the box state. So then once I have this geometry, then I want to do this. I want to calculate the correlation functions in the box basis, which is some combination of the boundary figure frames, and then look at this distance. So if I pick some correlation function, I can do this for both space and imaginary time. If I want to use mutual information, then that only applies to space. So that's one open question, like how do I find a nice measure? Another open question is how do I find a nice measure of distance in real time? That's also something I'm working on. So let me go to the specific example, which is also, in general, it's hard to calculate all these correlation functions in the bulk because they are like very non-local correlations on the boundary. Not non-local, but they involve a lot of sites. I check this for free fermion. So I considered a 1+1 dimensional Dirac fermion, it's just a Dirac fermion regularized on the lattice. I wrote this in the K space. you replace K by sine K and add a regulator on the mass term. You just define this unitary mapping, which is very simple with real space RG. So you take the fermions on the two sides, and then the low energy, what you call low energy or long wavelength, is the equal weight zero position of them, and then the other one is the anti-symmetric combination. So if you Fourier transform, this one is close to this one, mainly contains momentum near zero. This one mainly contains momentum near pi. So that's just a block spin transformation in real space. And then so now if you apply this mapping, so you get B, which is the zero position of C1, C2, and then in next layer you take the A here, and then you take the same combination, you get B here, which is A1 minus A2, which is like 1+2 minus 3 minus 4. So because this transformation is quadratic, which means it maps free fermions to free fermions. So this in this simple example, this really corresponds to just a choice of a new basis in the single particle superspace. So this new basis is actually called a power wavelet. So when I say I have a fermion on this side, what that means on the boundary is that you have a fermion living in that wave function that has this square shape, where this has +1, this has -1 amplitude. So if you have it on a different side, then you have a different wave function. Oh, this thing disappeared. But, oh, here. Yeah. You have a different wave function with a different size and position. So the wavelet basis is labeled by two numbers. One is the position, one is the radial direction energy scale. And then now you just want to calculate correlation function in that new basis B, and then measure the distance. So one thing to mention is that this mapping keeps the Hamiltonian on the fixed point, in the sense that if I, say, do the first step of the mapping, which maps the C's to A and B, and A represents the low energy state. So then Hamiltonian looks like low energy part and high energy part, and then the coupling. So if you only look at the low energy part, it means if you do the ordinary RG, throw away the high energy things, then the low energy part has a Hamiltonian that looks the same as before, except the mass is doubled, and there's the overall boundary normalization. There's the overall 1/2 factor. So it's really like a discrete version of the RG. And then if mass is zero, then the Hamiltonian is on the fixed point. And because all the later layers are determined by the low energy A, at the long state A, if you look at this network, then everything later is determined by the output, by the low energy part. The high energy part is kept there and you don't touch them anymore. So if the A Hamiltonian remains the same, then the whole network is scale invariant, which means if you have this property, then the correlation function between B are naturally scale invariant. So that's sort of like a RG scheme I choose, which maps this critical fermion, maps this critical fermion to a scale invariant geometry. So then let's first check that. We check the case where zero mass and zero temperature, so the boundary system is a critical fermion. And then the bulk, I can calculate correlation functions between different points, and then take a log, measure distance. So you see that, not surprised that the distance in this direction goes like a log of the Euclidean distance. And then you can compare that with what we expect in the ADS. So to compare that, I need to embed this network into ADS. And in this special case, there is scale invariance. So scale invariance determines the embedding up to one number, which is the ADS reader. So basically, if you pick the position of the first layer, everything else is determined by scale invariance. But you have a choice where you put the first layer. So because I have a lattice constant. So if I fix the lattice constant to be one, so the ADS radius is meaningful. It's a measure in the lattice constant, and I can compare what I get from this calculation to the ADS distance to get what is R and what is R.
So the shortest distance that is not zero is sort of one or R or something.
Is of order R. Yeah. So basically, that's right. I can only compare. I mean this. This is also a approximate formula in long distance limit. I can only compare the long distance in the long distance large scale limit. In the small scale, I don't expect the correlation function to have a reverse form. It depends on different series. Yeah. So you see that if I fit this formula, I get an R that's 0.3 times the lattice constant, which is consistent with the fact that this still theory of the free fermion shouldn't have a locality in the scale smaller than R. I mean, everything here is like, every site here represents an area in ADS space of order R. So you only talk about the large scale geometry.
So you're trying to reconstruct hyperbolic geometry somehow?
In the large scale.
In the large scale,
right.
But there's this discrete choice you make in your a renormalization scheme that's
right.
Very asymmetrical compared to that. Do you
that's right.
Pay a price for that somewhere? Or
the mapping is still exact, so I didn't throw away anything. And then when you say it's very special, means it breaks the ADS symmetry, and that corresponds to the fact that I don't have a conformal symmetry on the boundary because this is a lattice system.
Well, what was bothering me was that it seemed you were covering the geometry of the tree rather than the hyperbolic plane.
So the key thing is that this tree just defines the mapping. The tree defines the way how the box space, how the boundary space comes in and are mapped to the box space. But the box space are coupled in this angle direction. So the box space, they don't live on something like a tie binding model on the tree. I mean, they have a boundary Hamiltonian, which is mapped to a bulk Hamiltonian by this unitary transformation.
Yeah.
The tree defines the transformation. But so say if I do the first step.
Okay, but then if you ask what the geometry is of the bulk Hamiltonian, will you get hyperbolic space out in the limit?
Well, in this special case, yes.
Yeah, in this special case.
In this special case, because of this property that the Hamiltonian has some kind of scale invariance.
Yeah.
So I cannot say I get the hyperbolic geometry because I cannot show you have the SO3 or SO21 symmetry. I mean, I have a scale invariant. So that's the reason why. I mean, that's consistent with the symmetry of the boundary. So in this special RG scheme, there is a scale invariant, but there is no conformal invariant. Means I cannot do a transformation which maps this point to that point.
If you let the trees become infinite in the UV,
do you get an SO2-1-1?
I don't think so.
Lenny Susskind talked about something very much like this.
Yeah, they told me that.
I think they have trees, and they actually have a discrete version of it.
That's right. I think that requires something like you, like this tree has an arrow. So these two things come in and this goes out.
Yeah, yeah.
There's one other index go out of the plane. And their tree has no arrow. So I don't know if that's possible, but if you choose the tensor where the three indices are equivalent, then probably you can redesign the tree in a way that you can map the center. You can move the center from here to some other point. Then that may correspond to some very special model where you have a sort of discrete version of conformal symmetry. But in this model, I don't have that.
Maybe you could have, instead of one tree, a probability measure over trees. That might be easier to achieve symmetry.
Yeah, but that means, I mean, that's sort of like I have some fluctuations in the bulk which are not dynamic living on the vertices, but the tensor state itself.
Instead of choosing one renormalization scheme, you choose all renormalization schemes.
Yeah, you can do that. I mean, I think that's closer to the picture where my bulk is like close to a classical geometry, and then the classical geometry is this manifold is fluctuating. So this case is like my bulk excitations are free fermions because I do a mapping map boundary free fermions to bulk free fermions. If you insist to view in that way, you can probably do that. But this is far from a classical geometry. So the fluctuations are not gravitons but free fermions. So formally you can think in that way because as long as the bulk state is certainly entangled, I can write it in a magic product state. Sorry, a tensor product state. But the tensor probably has a very high dimension. Once you write it as a tensor product state, then I can think that the dynamics is like the fluctuation of the tensors. Okay, so let me briefly say that then I can check the radial direction. So as a one consequence of the fact that there is no conformal symmetry, this center is really special, which means that the radial direction has a different correlation length. I mean, I cannot separate it with the R. So if I use the same R, I get a different correlation length. So you have a scale invariance, but there's a center which is special. So I can look at the time direction correlation where I don't know how to define mutual information. For free fermions, there is a natural way to pick the correlation function, which is you just pick the single particle correlation. So I pick the single particle correlation, and then I do it for two sites on the same position but different time. And then you compare it with the ADS formula, and that actually agrees quite well. It gives you a similar, and it's not exactly the same R. So basically, for critical system, you just get some correlation functions that are qualitatively consistent with the ADS space free fermions. The more interesting case is when I want to go beyond this. So compared to the previous tensor network approaches like MIRA, then the advantage is that here my geometry is defined by correlation functions, so the geometry can change even if the network is the same, because the network just defines the mapping between the two series. So I fix the network and I input a different state. So here I input a finite temperature ensemble, so a finite temperature thermal ensemble with the zero mass. And then I add a process that we know that should be dual to a black hole, and let's see how that come out. So now in space, let's separately look at space and time direction. In spatial direction, the correlation function you see a crossover from the log behavior. I mean, the correlation function crossover from power law to exponential, which means the distance I define crossover from log to linear. That's when you have two sites like this, which are in the UV region. And when you are near the IR region, then you see that there is a region where you completely lost the power law behavior in this region that's shaded out. That the correlation functions are exponentially small means the distance between two points are very big. And actually, I can measure the perimeter of each circle. In the zero temperature case, the perimeter is just exponentially decaying when I go to the center. So it's determined by scale invariance. And then here, what you see is that the parameter actually goes to a finite constant when you go to the center. Because the number of sites decays exponentially in every layer. In every layer, the number of sites reduces by half. But the correlation function between the two neighbor sites actually becomes very small in the sense that that when you look at the distance between two neighboring sites, it's increasing exponentially. So when you measure the parameter, it's actually going to a constant, and the constant is proportional to t. So that's the evidence that that you are approaching a black hole horizon. So the picture is that the whole disk here, the whole tree disk here, is mapped to the outside of the black hole. And when you are going to the center, you are not going to the center of the black hole, but you're going to the horizon of the black hole. So everything is outside, but this shaded region is like the stretch of the horizon.
So we have finally have many states in one sample.
Right.
We have
yeah. So you map the boundary density matrix to the bulk density matrix, and then you use the correlation function in the same way. You calculate the thermal correlation function in the bulk.
Right. If you do this for any state, which is a typical state of the ensemble, you get the same answer?
That's one thing we're doing now. I mean, the question is, what is a typical state? So because this free fermion is an integrable system, so if you just choose the Eigen state, it doesn't work. But we are studying that in a random state. I will show some easy results later. So that's one very interesting question about the micro state of black hole.
So you're starting with a one-dimensional system on a circle. Is that the idea?
Yeah, and map it to the disk. Map it to the red dot. So start from the blue, and then so you see that the correlation in this new coordinate looks like there is a black hole in the center. But this is not the easiest way to see that there's a black hole. So the better way is that you look at the time direction correlation. I mean, I can look at the imaginary time direction correlation. And then what happened is that, so the imaginary time direction correlation, so here is a schematic that this color change means that when you calculate two points between here and here, the correlation decays. And then when you go to the center, the correlation decays slower and slower. And that's just a fact that's because of that. That's because the site in the center has an energy scale much smaller than temperature. And when the fermion has energy scale much smaller than temperature, your density matrix is like almost an identity there. So there's no much time evolution. So when you calculate the correlation function, it's almost independent from time. And when you translate that into distance, that means so the correlation decay corresponds to distance increase. So when you go to the infrared region, then the distance almost does not increase. So that's the evidence that your time direction actually becomes more and more lifelike when you go to the center. So that tells you that you're not approaching just a cutoff of space. You are actually approaching a boundary of space-time, which is the horizon. I mean, you are approaching the black hole horizon. So the boundary time direction is becoming more and more lifelike. And you can fit this correlation function. Fit these correlation functions to get this similar relation between the parameter, which is given the row parameter, and the index. So when you go to the center, this parameter approaches some constant, and that constant is proportional to temperature. So basically, this is a very simple model, but it tells you that intuitively why I have a black hole corresponding to a thermal state. Just because when I do this mapping and separate different energy scales, then there is a region, there's an IR region where the energy scale is smaller than temperature, and then the correlation in space basically fall apart. And there's the points are very far away, but they have very little time evolution. And that's why you're close to a horizon. So that gives you infinite redshift. And you can also explicitly study the entropy, because I have this bulk quantum theory, and at every site there is an entropy. And then you can calculate the entropy means is the entanglement entropy of this site with the rest of the system and the thermal mass. So you see that the entropy is maximum almost everywhere. So if you count the area of the stretch of the horizon, how many sites are here? I mean, I'm drawing this schematically. So when you go to the center, you are approaching this horizon. So in this red region, there's a stretch of the horizon, and the number of sites there is proportional to temperature, and every site is maximally entangled, so the entropy is also proportional to temperature in this case. So, okay, so now, one briefly, one thing briefly to mention is that I can compare this with another situation where there is zero temperature but a finite mass. So if you have zero temperature finite mass, then there is a similar behavior in the spatial direction correlation. So you see there is a IR region where the correlation becomes linear, where the distance becomes linear in the bleeding distance. So you see something is happening in IR. But if you look at time direction correlation, there is a finite scale which is given by the mass. So the time direction correlation, so the time direction distance remains in the linear function of tau. So the time direction is finite. So that's why, like in this case, there is like a cutoff in the IR rather than horizon. There is the space terminates, but time is still going on. So you can also see that from the entropy. So the entropy in the black hole case in the IR region is maximum. In this finite mass state, it decays to zero. So that means, that's consistent with the fact that the mass goes up. So there is very little correlation between different sites, and every site is in the ground state. So now let's go back to the black hole case, basically. I mean, I think have some better understanding to the black hole by considering the double system. So we can consider the thermal field double system, and by creating two chains that are entangled to each other. And in the free fermions, you can easily design that state by writing down a top-in Hamiltonian and then find the ground state of that, require the ground state to be this. And then now I do the mapping in the same way. So the mapping doesn't directly couple the two. The mapping is done separately to the two sides. So this tree networks is drawn separately. But then I can measure the distance not only between points in one side, but points between two sides. If I measure distance in one side, then it's the same as the black hole case, because it trace over the other side, it's a thermal density matrix. But you can measure distance between the two sides, and because of the entanglement between them, the distance is finite. And then what you see is that the distance between these two sides that are right on top of each other decays exponentially when you go to the center. And it goes to zero, which means, remember, zero distance means maximum entanglement. So what that tells me is that in this thermal double state, every site in the IR is maximally entangled, and it's not maximally entangled with the rest of this system. It's maximally entangled with the thermal gas, with the double. So everything here is maximally entangled with the double. And if you look at the geometry, that because the distance vanishes exponentially, that tells you that these two regions are actually connected through the IR. That's why it tells you that there is a Einstein-Rosen bridge built. So in this case, that's consistent with this thermal double geometry. And then we can try to perturb more, probe some other properties of this system by looking at some quench. So this is what motivated by this work of Tom Hausmann and Juan Malcina, where they consider this time evolution. So I think you call it HR plus HL or HR minus HL, depending on the convention. But it means that's the Hamiltonian that doesn't preserve the thermal double state. There is another one, which is the boost, which preserves the thermal double state. And this one changed the state. And then so it changed the state by adding the imaginary phase. And then you measure distance between the two sides, it will be different. So what they find is that the distance between the two sides as a function of boundary time will increase in linear in T. And in their paper, they were interested in minimal surface area, but that's the same in the three-dimensional case as a geodesic distance. So the distance is linear in T, and let's see what we find in the free fermion case. In the free fermion case, I can do the same thing. By the way, I wrote down the explicit form of the Hamiltonian, which has that as a ground state. So this is a quantum point problem that at time smaller than zero, you are in the ground state of this, which is the thermal double state. And then you switch off the coupling so that it evolves this in this Hamiltonian. And then you see the distance between two points right on top of each other as a function of the time after a quench. And that's actually going like log t. And that's because the mutual information goes like 1 over t. So when you take the log, then you get a log t. So that's the difference from the classical space-time case that in the Hartmann-Malcina paper. And the physical reason of this difference is that the if you translate, assuming this formula works, if you translate their distance back to a mutual information, and that's like an exponential of AT, which is linked, which is exponential. And I think, by the way, I believe this is true if you consider consider corrections to real-time analogy formula. Like to the leading order, the mutual information is zero between two things on the two sides in the classical case. But if you consider the corrections, the leading order does look like exponential of the distance, of the minimal surface area. So you get some mutual information which is exponential decay in the interacting case, and in the free case, it's power law. So the reason is that I think in free case, basically, you have two things that are entangled to each other. And then when you evolve in time, this single particle wave function just propagates. And at time t, it propagates into a region with the area t. So it's a spreading of the information. And then locally, if you measure the correlation, it decays in 1 over t. But in the interacting system, your information is propagated into an exponentially big Hilbert space corresponding to this region, which is exponential t. So that's why, I think that's why this decays exponentially in the interacting case. And this is the picture which just shows how when you perturb this system, then the wormhole disappears. This blue region is the region where distance is zero, so it's a wormhole. The wormhole disappears. And then, another difference from interacting theory is this thing has a very short recurrence time. Because everything is integrable, so what happens after the quantity is that everything propagates around the system and then comes back in the time that's the system size.
What's the scale?
It's a system size divided by speed of light is 1. Like I have a length of the system. So the wormhole just got stretched and then come back again periodically. Can I take another? I mean, I want to. So far is the thing that I was in the paper I posted on archive, and then I want to just show some ongoing works about the black hole theory. I mean, you see that although this is a very special model for black hole, there are some general features which may hold for more general cases. So the stretch of the horizon is a highly entangled part. Basically, I think in general, if you have a highly entangled state, then either your bulk space-time is everywhere highly entangled, or the best thing you can do is you push all the high entanglement in one part, and that's like the black hole stretch of the horizon. And so your classical space-time starts to break down there, and then there is an infinite redshift, which is just because your state there is highly entangled, so your reduced density matrix is close to identity, so time evolution is very, very inefficient. So one thing we checked is related to the earlier question is this is a different random perturbation. I will go back to the pure state. We can do a random perturbation to the thermal field double state. So in the thermal field double is a very special state where the entanglement between the two sides is happening very locally, right on top of each other. So for example, there is the work of Steve Shankar and Douglas Stanford, where they show you create a shock wave or something. You can do something to disturb the system. And here, one thing we checked is that we can add a random phase between the two. So basically, the two sides are still entangled, but there is a random phase in this Hamiltonian, which means you are doing a random unitary transformation to one side without breaking momentum transient symmetry. So then you see that indeed the distance between the two start to get far away. So it's like the two wormholes. Originally in IR, they are contacting, and then now everything stretched out. So here in this region, in general, you don't have a well-defined space time anymore. So it's like creating some parallel in this way. Another way to try to probe this black hole physics in a more general state is we want to look at pure state, like some generic eigenstate. So if I have an interacting system, I will just follow this eigenstate thermalization hypothesis by Christian Jadzianicki to take an eigenstate and then map it to the bulk. But for free fermions, I cannot do that because it's integrable. But I can still take some random state. I mean, as long as it's not the special state, like with a given fixed NK and a number of fermions on each side, I can see some random superpositions of them. So one thing we checked is that we start from a random state determinant state, which means you do a random unitary transformation as long as it preserves the quadratic property of the fermion. So you do a random quadratic transformation to the fermion on some Dirac product state. So what you get is a state determinant wave function, and the wave function, the matrix that gives you a state determinant is exponential IT, which is some random unitary. So that's the most random thing we can do without introducing interaction. And then this state, I think you can prove that the if you have a big enough system, this coordinate function will look like an infinite temperature, because this correlation is just given by unitary, it's given by the random unitary matrix. And if the matrix is big enough, and it should look like a self-average, and it gives you a delta function that's just like an infinite temperature. So then we can introduce an annealed state from that, because we want something which is random, but it knows about the energy scale. There is some average energy. So one thing we did is we cool down this a little bit. So we use the imaginary time evolution on top of this random state. So then we study the correlation function in this random state. So you see that it's similar, but it's different from the thermal double state. It's different from the thermal ensemble, but it also knows about these two regimes. There is a stretched horizon region where the correlation function is basically random. So it's like the random, it's the same as like the random state I created. I mean the quench doesn't, the cool annealing doesn't affect that much. So this part is like the stretched horizon part, it has a completely random correlation, and then the UV part has a well defined ADS like geometry. So you see the correlation, the distance goes like ADS like at some as a function of this angle direction, and then when it touches the horizon, it starts becoming random. So this is just showing that the state, the Fermi, the average number of fermions looks like a thermal state. But remember, this whole state is a pure state. So you can have a pure state which the correlation function in the semi-classical region all looks good, but then you hide all the difference from thermal ensemble in the stretched horizon. And in the interacting theory, you can hide it better. Here everything is still in this two-point correlation. So that's why the stretched horizon doesn't really look like a thermal, because there are random correlations between different points. Okay, so I should conclude. Let me just briefly mention for a condensed matter purpose, we want to study the strongly correlated systems rather than free fermions. And for strongly correlated systems, we don't know how to calculate these kind of correlations in the bulk, starting from the boundary. If we know, we don't need to use this approach. So if you have a strongly correlated system you don't know how to solve, then it's better to start from the bulk state as an ansatz and then use the mapping to map it back to the boundary. So if I use a direct product state here, and if you allow me to change the network a little bit, then this corresponds to the mirror state. But here, I can generalize this mirror state by giving the bulk state some entanglement. But if the bulk state is short-range entangled, then one important thing is that this is a useful approach because the boundary correlation functions can be computed efficiently from the bulk. So how that works is that there is a causal cone. Which means that when you look at this way from bulk to boundary, only this shaded region will affect things here. And basically, you can think of these unitary mappings as a special time evolution, and that special time evolution has a light cone like that. And this time evolution is like a DS because the size of the space is changing. So the light cone has a special property that there's only log L number of sites in the causal cone. When the boundary size, system size is L. That's why it's efficient. Yeah, I have a very long system, but I only need to study the bulk states in a region that's size of, say, 2 times log L, if I'm interested in two-point function on the boundary. And then if your bulk state is a some Schwarzschild entangled state, you can represent the reduced density matrix by some multiplication of matrices. So it's, if your block is a tensor product state. So you represent the density matrix in this form, then you can show that your boundary density matrix is done, is obtained from this by doing some internal mission and then trace out something. So it's given by this picture. And the key thing in this picture is that there is this transfer matrix. So you just multiply these transfer matrices and then you can obtain the boundary reduced density matrix so you can calculate for linear function. So that means that you don't need to really do this finite size calculation to get the scaling dimensions of the operators. Because I can just, if I increase the system size by two, by a factor of two, I just add one more transfer matrix. So I can just diagonalize the transfer matrix to get the spectrum of all the operators in the boundary series. And that's why it may be useful. And this is the thing that we're doing now. So, I mean, of course, for any picture like this, there is a truncation. Like this line, dimension of this line times the dimension of these lines determine the how many operators you are looking at. But even if you keep the same mapping in the bulk, you can change the, you can increase the entanglement in the bulk state to get higher and higher cutoff in the scaling dimension. Okay, so that's the summary. So basically, some model for black hole, and on the other hand, it may give you some new approach to strongly correlate systems. And of course, there are many other questions. Thank you.
The gap system, which is topology oriented,
yeah,
one generally expected the bulk geometry should be, should have that encoding somehow. So how does it?
I think what happened is, the geometry itself doesn't know it, but you will have a, because it's a gap state, so you will have an IR cutoff. It's like a confined state, so you will have a spatial boundary in IR, which has the same topology as your space. So if your space is a torus in 2D times time, then your IR boundary is also a torus times time. And then I think on the IR boundary, there will be one state. No, there will be just the whatever grounded topological degeneracy you have.
The theory is not defined in total, but just you know, like this.
Mm-hmm.
When I do this, then I expect that the, in within any kind of Mera or any kind of Mera inspired holography, the entanglement should be very different because the subleading part.
Yeah, entanglement is right. Yeah.
Right, so how does it work out? How do I see the encoded entanglement is in the holography has that universal part?
Well, I would expect that something like I have my system, and then when you do this mapping, it's mapped to an IR, but there's a cutoff in the sense that correlation function. Well, in this approach, I don't really cut the network off, but everything about this region is direct products of each other, so you don't need them. And the geodesic never go there. So then I think for topological order state, what happens is if you calculate the entropy in this region, it will be like an area of this plus some contribution from here. And that takes account of the entanglement because there is a, like this whole thing is like a qubit which knows about the ground degeneracy. I think in Mera that has been studied for Langevin models. Yeah.
So we often think that things that are almost free on the boundary are due to these higher spin theories of gravity. Is there any way to see that structure?
That's a very interesting question. So I think the reason why I get a different theory is that I didn't project to any singlet sector.
Okay.
So it's really just a free fermion theory. Okay. So I'm allowed to talk about single fermion operator in the bulk rather than current. And so the conjecture will be, first, assuming there is a continuum version of this, which I haven't found, but it seems there's no reason why it doesn't exist. If you find a continuum version of this, which maps the free fermion on the boundary to some free fermion in the bulk, and then I can project that bulk free fermion theory to the singlet sector. I should get the Vasiliev theory. Mm-hmm. And basically, it's like saying if I have a free fermion, but I insist to look at the two fermion orbiters rather than one fermion orbiter, then it looks like many interacting bosons. It's like if you do bosonization to a fermi liquid. You get a lot of bosons, but actually the theory is a free fermion if you allow me to have a single particle.
I think we're going to have the trouble. We have a free fermion in the boundary and a free fermion in the bulk because the number of the freon is really different.
Yeah, that's the reason why I haven't found the continuum limit. I mean, I'm thinking how to get the continuum limit, and apparently one. I mean, we already know one mapping, which maps solutions of Laplacian equations in the bulk to fields on the boundary. So I need some kind of thing, something like that, some kind of restriction to the bulk Hilbert space so that they contain the same degree of freedom. Here, there is no problem because it's discrete. The number of sides matches. I think I can map the boundary free fermion theory to the bulk, but the bulk will already contain some UV cutout so that the degree of freedom matches the boundary.
You spoke briefly about perturbing the thermal field double state. Can you distinguish, and you said that it leads to the lack of classical space-time connecting the two regions. Are you able to distinguish between the lack of classical space-time versus long throats?
There's a region here where I cannot define classical space-time, that means none of the points on one side is maximally entangled with the other side, so they don't touch. I mean, so there's no neighbor. So one thing is that you can modify the mapping here, so that you basically, in principle, I think you can do it. You accumulate all the entanglement between the two sides to some region. So basically, you can do some transformation so that there are still some sides which are maximally entangled, and that's like more like a long throat.
There's a lot of questions that's sent on out there.